So this is the 24th of October, 2019. The IFC in Rhode Island, and we're restudying Canto 6, Chapter 17, Mother Parvati curses teacher K to the last verses 25 to 41. Okay, we have a lot to discuss in this section. So here the main thing is that devotees are exalted by their humility and by detachment. And here we found that Shiva and Parvati were very impressed by the behavior of Chitraketu, who was full of knowledge and detachment, and Lord Shiva glorified his qualities to everybody present there. And even though Chitraketu could have counter-cursed Parvati, he humbly accepted her curse and took birth as Vitrasura, but he remained a perfect Vaishnava. So, again, we have some little introduction here that Chitraketu leaves without further discussion. I apologize, I accept. There's not really any happiness and distress anyway. It's all okay. And he's gone. And then we have Lord Shiva. So who's there in this assembly? 26. Narada Muni. Narada Muni. You can see why Parvati mentioned Narada earlier. Yes. Narada not saying anything. He's there. And who else is there? There's some demons there. And who else?
Inhabitants of Siddhaloka.
Siddhaloka. Who else is there?
Who's
some associates? So who might those be?
Ghost.
Ghost. Might be ghosts and pisaches.
Nandi.
Might be Nandi. Who else might that be? Maybe Ganesh, Kartikeya, maybe some of those personalities. What? Whenever Lord Shiva's there, the demons. I'm not sure if that's always true. I don't remember a mention of the demons when Brahman, the demigods, went to see Lord Shiva after Daksha's sacrifice. I don't remember a mention of the demons being there. But anyway, there are demons there. Any thoughts about that? About this mix of beings and personalities over there?
How Lord Shiva is equal.
How Lord Shiva is equal?
It seems that Lord Shiva is just about to give some important instructions. For some reason, different entities.
Oh, so he was then, when he's supposed to give some important instruction, all these different entities show up. I think it's also significant that some of these demons and associates get to witness the behavior of Chitraketu and get to witness this whole exchange. There's no comment on this verse, but it seems significant that Chitraketu becomes a demon and there are demons there. They hear about this.
They all anticipated
this. Huh?
They all anticipated this.
Maybe. I don't know if they anticipated it, but I think it teaches something to the demons.
Do demons consider themselves demons?
Do demons consider themselves demons? Well, when we talk about demons, we often talk about, in the Bhagavatam, races of beings. So yeah, they consider themselves belonging to that race. Do they consider themselves evil? Very few beings who are evil consider themselves evil. And sometimes. Sometimes they rejoice in that. I'm really evil. But generally, evil beings, they rejoice in being against the established order, but they think that they're doing something good by being against the established order. So, you know, usually when people, like, yeah, they generally think that they actually, there's something good about themselves. All right. So we're going on to the qualities of Chitraketu and looking at text 77. So here, Lord Shiva is saying that the qualities of the Vaishnava, they're better than your qualities.
Which text?
27. Said that, you know, you're beautiful, you're glorious, you're powerful, my dear wife, but these Vaishnavas, their tolerance, their acceptance, their humility is more glorious. Right? Prabhupada writes, this is the excellence of a devotee. By mildly tolerating your curse, he has certainly excelled the glory of your beauty and power to curse him. Right? And then Prabhupada refers to what verse again? He refers again to the Trinadapi verse. This is the third, at least the third or fourth time within a few verses. Just like a tree, a devotee can tolerate all kinds of curses and reversals in life. This is the excellence of a devotee. Indirectly, Lord Shiva forbade Parvati to commit the mistake of cursing a devotee like Chitraketu. He indicated that although she was powerful, the king, without showing any power, had excelled her power by his tolerance. And just before we get into that, it says Lord Shiva smiled when he joked with his wife because others can't joke like that. So don't joke with Parvati like that. That's not advised. She's very powerful and she might not appreciate it. So we also have, this is a little side note, but it's also some indicator of etiquette. And a lot of this story is also about etiquette, isn't it? So it's a little side note about etiquette. That if somebody's a lot more powerful than you, if somebody's your superior, you know, you may not be able to joke with them about how they're not as great as they think they are. Of course, you would probably like to tell the story of how kings would have jokers who would insult, the king would pay them to insult him because all day long everybody's glorifying him and it gets boring. You know, so he'd have a paid person to insult him. Prabhupada likes to talk about that. That the king asked Gopal Bhan, what is the difference between you and an ass? And Gopal Bhan measures between him and the king. And he says, 3 feet, sir. You understand? Prabhupada likes to tell that story. So, what?
Dangerous job.
That was his job, right?
Dangerous job.
Dangerous job. It is a dangerous job. Very dangerous. Definitely. That's why Chanakya Pandit says, don't trust politicians. People like to say how he says, don't trust women. But he says, he says women, politicians, rivers.
Gamblers. Gamblers?
I don't think gamblers. That's in that list. I think that list is women, politicians, rivers, animals with horns, and animals with hooves. So what do they all have in common? They're changeable. They're all very changeable. The cow may be nice 1 minute and then buck you the next minute. Yes. Young women are changeable, yes? Hare Krishna. Okay, so we're going to do exercise here.
Can we trust the devotee?
Can you trust the devotee? Well, if somebody is above the bodily concept of life, they're not going to be affected by the changeable nature of their circumstance. And that's true also for a politician. So a politician like Yudhisthira, is not subject to the whims of Rajaguna. So if you have a woman or a politician who's not subject to Rajaguna and Tamaguna, then yes, you can trust them. But what we mean by trust here, and we old women aren't so changeable, by the way, that stops at a certain point. But the nature of the not trust is that all of those can change very quickly. It's not necessarily that you can't trust them with money or that they're not honest. It's not what it means. It doesn't mean that you can't, you know, that no politicians are trustworthy as far as keeping their word. I mean, the Vedic politicians were really good about keeping their word of honor, so that's not what it means. It just means that they can change, and they can change very suddenly.
Can we say as God is not affected by duality, similarly in devotees are not?
I'm sorry?
As God is not affected by the duality, similarly his devotees are not?
Well, that's true, but that's for a high level of devotee. It's not for the working on being a devotee category.
And Parvati, she is also Rudra energy of the Lord.
She's also a devotee. Well, this is what's always interesting, you know, when Lord Vishnu says to Lakshmi, you know, that he loves his devotees more than he loves her. But she's also a devotee, I mean.
She's also a devotee.
Of course. Parvati's also a devotee.
Serving the Lord.
But anyway, I understand this don't trust, again, is that they can change. They'll be in one mood at one time and they'll be in another mood at another time. Young women are like this, yes? I know, I was young once. It's the nature of young women. And it's the nature of people in positions of royalty that, you know, we see this in the governments of the world. They bring you in and they say, you know, you're going to be the Secretary of the Treasury, and then they fire you. Correct? This is what happens with politicians. The king of Thailand just did that. He just like threw out like four members of his royal entourage. You know, Donald Trump certainly does that all the time. Hires people and turns them out. He hires them and he says, you know, this is a great guy, this is a great woman, and they're going to do this and they're going to do this, and I trust them completely. And then, you know, 5 months later, he says they're a terrible person and they're disloyal and they're out. So, you know, Donald Trump may be an extreme example, and this king of Thailand seems pretty extreme also. But this nature of political leaders to do that, it's just what they do. So if you think I have the favor of a government officer and therefore I'm secure, don't trust it. I just like if you're petting an animal with horns. If some animal has horns and you're thinking, oh, this animal loves me, but it's an animal. It can suddenly go, you know. Or an animal with hooves. Or if you're with a woman and you think, oh, now she's happy, she loves me, and maybe that afternoon she's angry with you. Just the nature of the thing.
She's working under the direction of the Lord, Supreme Lord.
Yes, she acts as the shadow of the Lord Parvati.
But then the ultimate, the director is Lord?
Is the director Lord? Well, this is somewhat of the mystery of this pastime, and we'll get to that at the end of the class today. So hold on to that, because that's at the end, and I want to make sure I get there. Okay. So we want to look at beauty power and glory. Thank you. acceptance or acceptance. And blessings and curses. So if each of you could just think, just take a minute and think about this for a minute, and then I'm going to ask all you to help me fill this out. Okay, so this tolerance, it's very important to understand, first of all, in looking at this. Do some of you have some markers out and about, or are they all here? First of all, it's very important to understand the tolerance of a devotee is not repression. That's not, this is not tolerance. I'm tolerating. That's not tolerating. Tolerance is, we talked about this yesterday with Chitra Ketu's emotions. It's an acceptance. This is the will of God, this is the way it is, and I accept it. It's like those of us who come from first world countries, or even second world countries, and you come to India. India will make you go crazy if you don't just accept things. You know, there's just a lot here that in order to be peaceful, you have to just kind of accept, like the power going off and on all the time, the way the traffic works, and it's just, or even, you know, I was coming into Vrindavan today, and the roads were blocked. We couldn't get in. We tried two different ways, we couldn't get in. And in America, if they were going to block the roads, it would be announced, you know, a week in advance at least. And everybody would know, and you'd be able to plan for it. But we don't know until we get to the block. We don't know. The rickshaw wall just has to let me off and say, now you have to walk. You know? So this is just something, when you're in India, you just kind of accept. But if you're there, oh, I have to run, that's not tolerance. Yes.
Did you according to Shastra, like India only for self-realization. So we don't have like facilities like Europe and we have. So if somebody people, they
you know, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. Because the Shastra describes India as one of the most opulent countries in the world.
Yeah, but
so I don't believe that.
The opulence was taken before, no?
That's something else. But I don't see that by the design of, I don't see that God designed India to be a broken, poor country. This place is broken. It's really broken. I mean, I'm sorry. The roads are broken, the electricity's broken, and everything's broken. And I just don't believe that based on Shastra, that India is meant to be a broken place where you can just get spirituality. And part of the reason India is broken is it used to be so materially opulent that all the other countries of the world came here to take the opulence away. That was why everybody came here. Because a God-conscious country, according to Shastra, should be a prosperous country. There's a connection, Krishna talks about in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, between God-consciousness and material prosperity. I'm correct, yes. It's a connection that Srila Prabhupada makes all the time, between a God-conscious civilization and a prosperous civilization. So you have a case here where other countries stole from India. But anyway, my point is you come here, there's a lot you have to just accept. It's difficult. It's not an easy thing to do at all. But that kind of acceptance is very different than tolerating. The word tolerating generally in English usually implies some sort of being annoyed, some sort of irritation, and your feelings, irritation and annoyance, but you just go on anyway, you just kind of push through it. But that's not what we're talking about here. Here we're talking about really genuinely accepting that this is the way it is, and it's ultimately something good. It's something arranged by the Lord, and I really want to make this a very, very clear distinction and to get to this acceptance. Acceptance implies a sense of inner what?
Peace.
It implies a sense of inner peace.
It's like somebody had a heart attack or stroke, and they have a meditation after just a little while that they have to slow down.
Yes.
And they have to just. It's more acceptance than something happening on the road or something like that.
Well, either way. I see it either way. I don't see one as different from the other.
Because they have to adjust their life accordingly.
No, but I don't honestly see one as different from the other. I really don't. Whether it's a temporary illness, whether it's a change in the body that's going to be there till you die, whether it's finances, whether it's a family situation, whether it's something on the road or, you know, whatever it may be, it's something opposite to what you wanted or you planned for. I didn't plan to have to walk an extra half an hour to get into Vrindavan today. That wasn't my plan. Thank you, Krishna. I left 15 minutes earlier this morning. I kept saying, thank you, Krishna, that I left earlier. But it wasn't my plan. It was something contrary to my plan. So you don't. No one plans to get a heart attack or a stroke. It's the same kind of thing. Whether it's a traffic jam or a heart attack, or you know your wife leaves you for another man, or your father dies and doesn't give you any inheritance, or you go to get a job and you lose it 2 weeks later, whatever it may be. You know, you want to light some incense to offer your deities and none of the matches work. I mean, from one end of the spectrum to another, it's things that happen that are not, like Prabhupada says, reverses. There are things that happen that are not what I expected or what I planned for or what I wanted. Because I don't have to tolerate things that I like. You know, that's not a problem. But the things that I don't like, you know, things that I didn't anticipate or that I didn't plan for. I don't see a difference between those. I mean, one you may have to tolerate for half an hour and one you may have to tolerate for 20 years. But it's the same kind of thing where how do we respond to some situation where I'm obviously not the controller. You know, it's just I'm not the controller. What's our response? So acceptance is a place of a lot of peace. Real acceptance is it's genuine peace. And it's not a thing where, okay, I don't like this, but what can I do? I'll just do the best I can, but I'll complain about it, or you know, it's not like that. Okay, and then the power of blessing, there's a certain beauty, power, and glory to this acceptance. If it's real, deep acceptance, if it's not resignation. Resignation is, oh well, what can I do? I had a stroke and now I can't do so much anymore. Oh well, I don't like it. That's another thing. Or like I stayed in a place here, it wasn't very clean a few nights ago, and I didn't really accept it. I was just resigned to it. I just thought, I'm too tired to clean. I'm just too exhausted to clean. And every time I walked on the floor, my feet were like, every step was like, so that, I was resigned to it, but I didn't accept it. Acceptance is different. Acceptance is when you really, it's almost like you welcome it. You know, it's almost a kind of embracing it. I talked yesterday about how, you know, I experienced this equanimity towards pleasure and pain in childbirth with my second child. by meditating on Govinda's belt with my labor in childbirth for the third child, I took it another step forward. And I was really embracing the situation. I was just welcoming. I was just like, yes, yes. And then I went way beyond neutrality. I went way beyond observing the situation with zero pain to actually having not only zero pain, but having a lot of joy. And it was just an amazing, amazing experience. And the midwife who was there, she said, I know what your body's happening. What's going on with your body? Because you're just so happy all the time. That kind of acceptance. I was cracking up actually. My husband and I were joking the entire vision. So that kind of acceptance where you really go beyond neutrality, where you really joyfully welcome a situation is something that gives beauty, power, and glory. And now we're going to contrast this to, because that's what Chitraketu is exhibiting here. He's not just resigned to the situation. He's not gritting his teeth. He's not just, all right, well, what can I do? I was having a lot of fun with these ladies doing sankirtan in my airplane, having everybody praise me, but oh, darn it. Now I got to go into demon body, but all right, it's the will of the Lord, what to do. But that wasn't where he was at. And then we're going to look at Parvati with these blessings and curses. So she has a lot of power. If I say to any of you, go become a demon, nothing's going to happen. Not to you, anyway. Krishna will be upset with me, so something will happen to me. I'll lose some mind. My minuscule taste I have for bhakti will become even more minuscule. So it will affect me, but I have no effect on you. So to have this sort of effect that you can bless somebody and they get blessed, and you can curse somebody and they get cursed, that's really something. Probably a lot of us would like to have that power. I mean, I would. I'd like to be able to go to the people I love and say, may you be healed, and then they're healed, and I'd love to be able to do that. May you have Krishna prema. That would be so cool. And I don't know if I ever really wanted to curse somebody, probably once or twice in my life. But that would probably be a cool power to have too. Just like, stop, freeze, silence, you troublesome person, and then they just kind of freeze so they can't say anything anymore. That would be cool. Actually, I would probably like that. I would like that too. So that's the power that Parvati has. She has that kind of power. And Lord Shiva is saying, Chitraketu's beauty, power, and glory of his acceptance is greater. All right, so let's look at this. What's the beauty of this acceptance? How is it beautiful?
Because he did not return it.
How does that make it beautiful?
Because if he didn't accept it, he get angry and the body will change.
Oh, I like this.
You know, when somebody get angry, all the symptoms of the anger.
Yeah.
And not peaceful. And he was peaceful. Peaceful.
That's very profound what you just said. So our emotions, we talked about this yesterday, how Chitraketu's mentality was evident in his physical actions, his philosophical points, and his emotions. These things are related to one another. So when one has this real acceptance, one's body becomes beautiful. One actually starts, it shows in the body. Just like anger shows in the body. Okay. So it shows in the body. Prabhupada liked to talk about his disciples as being very bright-faced. There is a difference. Okay, is there any other way in which this acceptance is beautiful? Yes.
To have this deep acceptance is a kind of an exhibition of devotion to the Lord. Also. Have devotions.
Okay, so it's related to love. Related to love and devotion, which is something that we see as beautiful. Yes?
Any display of virtuous behavior is always, heartening, elevating, and ennobling.
I think we could say it's attractive.
Yes. Encouraging, inspiring.
But we're looking particularly at beauty here. I think we all have experience with meeting people who physically are not very beautiful, but they have such a wonderful character that as we get to know them, we come to see them as attractive. Do you all have experience like that? I have a god sister who's really, even as a young woman, she was very funny looking, physically. But she was such a sweet-hearted person that after you got to know her within 2 or 3 weeks, you didn't look at her as a funny looking person anymore. You actually saw her as at least average looking. And I also remember one god sister who physically was extremely beautiful, just like the kind of beauty that people would probably look at on the street. But her character was not very nice. She had a real nastiness to her character. And again, after a few weeks, you really couldn't see her as being beautiful anymore. It was sort of, you've had that experience that people were physically very attractive, but they're so nasty, and they're so critical, and after a while, you look at them and you think, how did I even think that that person was attractive? Yes?
There was beauty in his words also. Instead of person.
Oh, I like this. That this mentality, I'll tell you, this kind of thing is why I like teaching Shastra. Because I hadn't thought of any of these. I genuinely hadn't. Add so much to my own understanding. So it leads to pleasing words. Which is certainly a kind of beauty. Okay. Let's look at blessings and curses. The power to bless and the power to curse. What's the beauty of that? Looking at beauty. Don't look at anything else right now, just beauty. How is that beautiful?
It truly lifts up someone's. The moment you get a blessing or you're able to give a blessing, it really brings all the positive energy.
Okay. And a cursing can do what? It can remove the. I want to know how the power to curse can be beautiful.
Some curses are merciful. If somebody curses someone for the future benefits, that would be.
Okay, so it can bring out the positive and remove the
negative.
Part of beauty is to be able to remove what's not beautiful. Yes? Beauty isn't always adding. Sometimes beauty is subtracting. Like if you wanted to make a sculpture, sometimes they ask artists, how do you sculpt this stone? And they say, I see the elephant hiding in the stone. And then I take out everything that's not the elephant. You've heard this from sculptors? So this allows you to bring out the beauty power to bless any person could be beautiful.
Only when it purified person can give the blessing or the curse to it.
Not necessarily, because it's certainly possible in this universe to get power through karma and austerities, even if you're not a very nice person. We have lots of examples in our shastra of people, because Krishna is dependable, as Rupa Goswami explains. If you follow the rules, you will get power even if you're not a nice person. Then Krishna has to find another way to take away your power because you follow all the rules, like with Hiranyakashipu. So any other way in which the power to your blessings and curses is beautiful.
Generate respect for the person he is power.
Respects.
The person who can bless or curse. And is looked upon with respect.
Oh, so that they become attractive. I think that's a fact. I think there's a kind of attractiveness. So this power is attractive. It's attractive in a different way than virtue, but it is attractive. And it's definitely, if we look at the six opulences, this would probably be in the virya category. And this would probably be in the vairagya category. So this would probably be vairagya and this would be virya. And both virya and vairagya are attractive. They're both opulences. Okay, let's look at power. Acceptance, having this mood of acceptance and welcoming of reversals, what's the power of that?
It's written here that, as Lord Shiva says, our power of tolerance and acceptance exceeded, he's telling
power. How? I want to know how.
Exceeded the power.
Yes, that's the whole point of this exercise. But I want to know how. In what way?
It even attracts the powerful. Like which the Chitraketu. I mean, even Lord Shiva is attracted by Chitraketu's tolerance. Because he's more powerful.
I think that's beauty. We already talked about how it's attractive. I wonder how it's powerful. Yes.
Humility is powerful.
How specifically?
Because only humble person can tolerate.
Okay. What you people are doing so far is you're doing something in logic called the tautology. You're saying it is because it is. Yes.
Well, it allows Chitraketu in this case of general that you don't have to suffer.
It removes suffering. That's pretty powerful. It removes or prevents suffering. In this world, the pharmaceutical industries are worth billions and billions of dollars or euros or whatever. But a mood of acceptance makes pain go away or prevents it from happening. Any of you have chronic pain, I will tell you that there are mind-body techniques that make pain go away. And this is one of them. It actually removes pain. Even if there's a physical cause, even if you have a broken bone or whatever, it takes the pain. You simply don't have any pain, even on a physical level. What to speak of on a mental level. It removes pain. It removes any kind of sensation of pain. In what way? That's pretty powerful. That's pretty pretty powerful. There are a lot of doctors that do teach that, but you can see why not every doctor teaches it, because it's not the kind of thing you can make a lot of money off. You can make a lot more money with, you know, chiropractors and pills and special diets than you can teaching people how to adjust their mind. I mean, you can still charge for the teaching sessions, but it's not, it wouldn't be a multi-billion dollar industry. Yes, Alice, is it powerful?
We have this famous episode of Gandhi, you know, the Sarand March, Gandhi March. A row of people kept advancing to make Sarand, and they were beaten up, and they didn't retaliate at all. And they, when they fell down, then a few more came.
I was hoping somebody would bring this up.
So this had the power of, you know, overwhelming the...
But I would like you to go underneath what you just said and tell me why.
Ultimately, the super soul within them, the perpetrators of cruelty, you know, they generated the super, this thing, noble idea.
You're going mystical. Can you not go mystical on it? And let's just look at, you know, the salt march, which wasn't anything spiritual. Or, you know, the Martin Luther King Jr. in America, who followed in Gandhi's footsteps. So then this concept of a nonviolent accepting response to those who have the power to bless and curse, to having someone on one side with the power to bless and curse, and the person on the other side who doesn't resist. This acceptance also is, it's a non-resistance. Okay, I'm going to tell you a little secret. All suffering, physical suffering, mental, emotional, it's all 100% due to resistance. Completely. Doesn't matter what it's from. Doesn't matter what the pain is from. It doesn't matter that you're in pain because your wife left you for another guy. It doesn't matter if you're in pain because, you know, your vertebrae are out of alignment. It doesn't matter what the cause is. All experiences of pain are due to resistance. And when you give up resistance, you get a certain kind of power that's greater than the power of those who have the... Just think about this for a minute. The people who can bless and curse, they can give you material happiness and material distress. But non-resistance means you don't feel those things. So how does that give you power?
Because you are above their rule. Because you are no more into their jurisdiction.
Yes. Blessings and curses are ineffective. You're out of that rule. We can all see this on a very small level. When we genuinely say, I don't care, and we really don't care. If someone says, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, we go, well, I don't care, but we do care. That's something else. But if someone says, well, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, I'm not going to play with you anymore, right? Our friends said this sometimes, even Krishna's friends said this to me. But if we, you know, if we actually don't care, then the person loses all ability to influence us. Does this make, we've had this experience? If someone says, you know, I just had this, someone was just telling me about this experience, that our family runs a program out of Radhakund, Govardhan, where we take care of the widows and we clean Govardhan. some donor said, you know, I want to give you $500 a month, but I want you to use it in this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. And we said, well, that's not what we do. That's a different program. You know, if you want to give the donation for what we do, that's fine. And if you want to donate for something else, it's not our program. We didn't care. Because we didn't care, the person had no power over us. If we care, you're like, oh my God, I got to get that $500 a month, then we get under their power. And you see this if you bargain, you know, in a country like India where people bargain. What's the biggest bargaining chip? You walk away. Right? Isn't it? The guy goes, I want 800 rupees to take you there. And you're like, I'm only going to pay 700. 800. And you go, okay. But, and you walk away. But you have to be really walking away. If you're walking away looking, you know. But if you actually walk away, you're like, it doesn't matter to me. Then the person loses their ability to do anything to you. You nullify their power. Everybody follow? Yes. Is there any other way in which just acceptance and non-resistance gives power?
Like when someone is really giving some trouble and we accept and we just tolerate it, there is also a chance that we can change their mind, mentality.
Why? How does that work? Sorry, I keep pushing for this. Why does acceptance and non-resistance, why does it have the power to change somebody who's pushing some blessing of hers?
Because they see that we are not fighting on their mind, but we stopped so they can genuinely have some time to think. Okay, maybe they are right.
Sure, I think it was a little bit beyond that. Because people who have the power for blessing and cursing, and this doesn't just mean mystic. Like all governments have this blessing, cursing power, yeah? They can let you into their country, they cannot let you into their country. They can let you be free, they can put you in jail. They can let you build your house, they can tell you we have a new rule and now you can't build your house there anymore. They all have this kind of blessing cursing power. When they meet someone who's just like, you want to bless me? Fine. You want to curse me? Fine. I'm happy either way. It doesn't matter to me. What kind of emotion do you think the people with the power might feel?
Confidence.
Confidence?
Frustrated.
Huh? They might get very frustrated, and then they usually try to increase the blessings and power to see when you're going to break. When you're going to care. But suppose you really just don't care. You're just accepting whatever. What emotion are they going to feel?
Helplessness.
Helpless! And what else? Generally, and you talked about maybe changing those in power. That usually comes from surprise. I mean, Hiranyakashipu didn't lose interest. Here we had an example. Hiranyakashipu had a blessing, cursing kind of power, and Prahlad was like, oh.
Sense of
guilt. Yeah, bless me, curse me, it doesn't matter to me.
Sense of guilt.
Huh?
Sense of guilt.
Excessive greed?
Guilt, guilt.
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 Maybe.
Yeah.
What's the power of being able to bless and curse? This is the easiest one.
To change their karma.
What power do the blessers and cursers? Well, we all have really little power to bless and curse others, right? Don't we have a little bit of power to do good or ill to others? Yeah. But those who really have a lot of power, I say governments, a lot of power. Parvati has really, really, really high power to bless others. She's way up there. She's way beyond any president or prime minister or general or whatever, puncher. This is the simplest one.
It can change our life.
And how does that give them power?
Control.
What can they control? They control others' what?
Activities.
Yes. They control others' activities and behavior.
Fate.
Huh?
Control the others' fate. Others' fate is a blessing. A demigod or God is a blessing.
We're not talking about God. This is not about God. I mean, here we are in VIT, and we're not talking about God. I don't mean that. But I mean, this comparison, we're not talking about God. We're talking about beings who have the power to give blessings and curse, and beings who have this power of acceptance. Krishna has both to an unlimited degree. We're not comparing Krishna's opulences. But yeah, they can affect. Isn't this how many managers, controllers, governments try to change people's activity through rewards and punishments? Right? By the way, it's not the most effective way to change people's activities. There are far more effective ways, but that's another discussion which we're not having today. But this is how they try to control their activities. Like there was a blockade up in Vrindavan, and if we had just gone through it, we would have been cursed, so to speak, by the police officers. Right? And because we know that they have that power, we didn't go through. Can they also control others' emotions? When we're not accepting, how do we feel around those who can bless us and curse us? Yeah, we're afraid. Exactly. That's why the beginning of this says Chitrakechu didn't have any fear. So, what causes all of our pain, 100%, is fear. Again, whether it's a backache, whether it's you're upset because somebody cheated you, it doesn't matter what kind of pain it is, it's all caused by fear, which causes resistance. All of it, 100%. So people who can bless and curse, they also control the emotions of others, particularly through fear. But they also control the thoughts of others. People think in a way that they want to please those who can bless them and not displease those who can curse them? And do people make mental thoughts for that purpose? Okay. Glory. What do we mean by glory? Kind of splendor. It's probably related to beauty. But I think it's a little different. It may be more the rasa of adbhuta rather than beauty. Wonder, like astonishment. So how is this acceptance and non-resistance, how is it glorious?
She was glorified
to
get to that.
Okay, but I'm going to keep doing the same thing. Why? What's glorious about it?
Because they have tolerance and they accept any weird circumstances.
So you're doing a tautology. I'm saying, why is this acceptance glorious? And you're saying, acceptance is glorious. Acceptance is glorious because it's glorious to be accepted. you're like, that's like the 10th time someone has given me a tautology here. So, please don't mind that I'm pushing you a little deeper. Sometimes when people say things like that, I don't say anything, I just let it go. But I'm pushing here. I'm pushing you to go deeper. Please don't be offended. How is it glorious? This is hard stuff. If it wasn't hard, I wouldn't be pushing like this. And just everybody sit down and do this at your desk. But it's not easy. What's glorious about it?
In the first place, no one needs to take it, but someone is ready to accept it.
I think you're very close. I think you're almost touching it. You're like smelling it from a distance.
There do not appear any condition of that.
That's again a tautology. Yes.
Because it attracts the attention of Krishna.
In and of itself, no. In and of itself, this is a material opulence. This is simply an opulence of vairagya. This is an opulence of virya. So Chitraketu is attracting the Lord by his vairagya because, and we'll get to this, because his vairagya is coming from his bhakti, it's not just vairagya. You can have vairagya without bhakti. It will have a limit. But it's not that the impersonalists don't have vairagya, they do. And the impersonalists also have this extreme acceptance. They genuinely do. Yes.
An allied devotion to Vasudeva.
Yes, but I'm looking just at this non-resistance as something, just looking at it in and of itself. What is its glory?
Yes.
It's very independent. No, not entirely, because any material opulence is dependent on the Lord. But of all the material opulences, this is the most independent. Would you think about this for a minute? The beauty of our body, the beauty of our environment, isn't that dependent on so many things? Our wealth, our strength, our knowledge, our leadership power, those are all dependents. This could also be in the category of Aishwarya. This could be Virya and Aishwarya. They're all dependent on circumstances that aren't fully under our control. Are you all following that? But this vairagya, real vairagya, is something that comes from our inside. It's very hard for someone else to take it away. Someone else could take away my beauty easily. You know, cut off your nose and ears, your beauty's gone. It's not hard to take away someone's beauty. You could take away someone's wealth. You could take away somebody's leadership, take away somebody's strength. How do you take away somebody's vairagya? It's really not possible. So it has a kind of glory of being independent. Are there any other glories to this acceptance? You're not going to come, and then you give us great happiness by coming anyway.
Not so punctual.
Well, considering we didn't expect you at all, it's lovely to have you with us at all.
Business, okay.
He is indeed.
With everyone.
He is indeed. I'm sure if you didn't come, that would also be a kindness on you in some other way. So, why else is it glorious? things that are glorious, okay? Think about some Olympic athlete. An Olympic athlete does something that's glorious. Everyone's glorifying that person. Why? Why do we glorify Olympic athletes or geniuses?
They do something that no one else is able to do.
It's very rare. And it's very difficult. It's rare and it's difficult. Is it easy to just be accepting and non-resistant of everything? Is that easy?
No.
Oh, it's extremely, extremely difficult. We all do that with some things, or we would be, not functional.
I think I understand non-resistant, but can you...
You know that you just pop in the middle of class, and then you want me to spend the time catching up for the last hour and 20 minutes? I'm happy that you come late, but I'm not going to do that. Yes?
Can you see this heroic or exemplary?
It's very exemplary, yeah. This is another reason why it's glorious. Okay, what's glorious about the ability to bless the curse?
It's rare. Not everybody
can. Everybody has it to some extent. But we could also say that higher levels are rare, right? The level that Parvati has is very rare. Everybody has this to some extent. What else about it is glorious? What can you act as here? Parvati is acting, many of you brought this up. She's acting as the
mother.
Not just the mother, she's acting as the
wife.
She's acting as the agent of the Lord. And this particularly, this power to bless and curse others, it definitely goes with Aishwarya. It's a controlling power. And those who have this, it's also glorious because to some extent they represent the power of God. Correct? So we can say it gives one the opportunity. It gives one the opportunity to represent God's power in the world. You may not do it, but it gives you that opportunity. Do you all understand? Any government leader is supposed to be a representative of God. So if you take that ability to bless and curse, and you use it rightly, then you have a great opportunity. You have a great, glorious opportunity. We would love for the people in the world who have this power to be using it as a representative of God. Most of them are not.
So the tolerance we are talking is the absolute tolerance.
Okay, well, this is also the interesting thing. Now we're going to go to bhakti. In just a minute, we're going to go to the relationship between this and bhakti. Because what we've looked at here, we could be talking about a person who's vairagya and acceptance and non-resistance might be there from something other than bhakti. And we're going to go through that in a minute. I'd like to just make a little note of something that if you'd like to do it on your own, you can do it on your own. I plan to do it in the class only. You simply don't have time. So if on your own you would like to write something about a time when you were tolerant, genuinely tolerant and accepting, and how you felt beauty, power, and glory in your life from that experience. So if this is something, a self-reflective exercise that I think would really help each of us to go more deeply into this section and more deeply into the understanding of Chitra Ketu, but I simply don't have time to do that. So sometime when you were genuinely tolerant, when you genuinely, deeply accepted and welcomed and didn't resist a reversal in any way, not even to any extent, and how you felt beauty, power, and glory from that. Okay, let's go on to that. It's bhakti that's giving him this opulence. And here we're especially going on to text 28, that Chitraketu's, of course, Parvati's blessing and cursing is also coming from her bhakti. She's not an ordinary. But here we're glorifying Chitraketu. And his equanimity and acceptance and non-resistance is coming from bhakti because bhakti's giving him fearlessness. Is it obvious the relationship between fear and this ability to be accepting and non-resistant? Does everyone see? Do you all see the relationship? Is that relationship obvious from this thing we just did? Not so clear. Okay, so then I'll take a couple minutes to get into it. So why am I affected by the good or bad that someone can do to me or that circumstances can do to me? Because I'm afraid that I need the good in order to be happy and I need to avoid the good in order to avoid being unhappy. I'm convinced that I need a certain external arrangement in order to get pleasure and avoid pain, which leads me to be afraid of losing the pleasurable circumstances or of encountering the painful circumstances because I think I need them. And so therefore, those who have the power to give me pleasurable circumstances or to give me painful circumstances invoke fear in me. Will they give me the thing I want, or will they give me something that I don't want? Because I think that I need them. So full acceptance, a complete non-resistance, a total acceptance, can only happen when there's absolutely no fear of gaining or losing anything, because there's no concept of any kind of condition for my happiness. If I'm convinced that I need a clean room in order to be happy, then I have some fear of people who have control over the cleanliness of my room. If I think that I need some respect to be happy, then I have some fear over people who can give or take away that respect. Anything I'm convinced I need to be happy will give me some fear towards those who control that thing. Yes?
The devotees, they know that they are not afraid of fear to the governments, but they are forced to accept, they are making laws, they are forced to accept those laws.
But they don't think that those laws have anything to do with their happiness or distress. That is the difference. And this is what Chitraketu was saying that we were reading yesterday that sounded so strange. Where he said, nobody's the cause of this happiness and distress. It's basically all in the mind. It's all due to attachment. So if we're fixed in bhakti, see, the impersonalists can be very detached because they don't desire anything. They don't desire anything, good or bad. So if someone gives them good or doesn't give them bad, it doesn't matter to them. They're in a place of equanimity. But the devotee is on a higher level because they're actually enjoying something higher. Because we're Anandamaya Vyasat, just to be actually not having desires and not caring is not a very stable situation. But if I'm absorbed in the service of the Lord, then these lesser things have no meaning. They just don't have any meaning at all. It's like if in my house there's a big feast waiting for me. You know, if my daughter's prepared a feast for me, and when I go home tonight, there'll be a feast. Then it doesn't matter if somebody gives me something nice to eat during the day or not. It's just irrelevant. If you're, you know, Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, whether you give them money or not doesn't mean anything to them. It's just irrelevant. If you say to Jeff Bezos even, I'll give you, you know, $500,000, he'd be like, eh. It wouldn't mean anything. Or I'll take $500,000 away from you. It's meaningless. It just doesn't affect him at all. So the devotee who's absorbed in Krishna's service, they're just not affected by what can be given or taken away in terms of the body and the mind. There's no meaning. It's just completely irrelevant. Take it away, give it up, it doesn't matter. Because they have something else, they have another sense of happiness. And therefore, the devotees are completely glorious. Chitraketu is completely glorious because his vairagya is not a material opulence, and it is not coming from impersonal equilibrium, but it's coming from absorption in the Lord, which means that it's permanent and it's stable, and there's no limit to it. If I have material vairagya, there's some limit. We all accept and not resist certain things, but there comes a limit that we say, I can't accept this anymore. I'm going to resist this. I'm going to fight this. That means our fear kicks in. That means we say, oops, this level I start to become scared. And for the impersonalist, they have a limit in that they want something. They don't want to just be neutral. It's boring to be neutral. They don't have any place where fear kicks in, but they're bored. But for the devotees, they already have everything. So their vairagya is a spiritual opulence, not a material opulence. All right. What I'd like us to do, but we don't have a whole lot of time. Do you all know what a flow chart is? Everybody know what a flow chart is? Where you make like arrows and this leads to this and this leads to that. So I'd like you to make some sort of a graphic of how devotees can become exalted like Chitraketu. What's the process? And I'd like you to do this in groups. So if these two ladies in the back can work with some ladies in the front, please. And six. We have two groups of three. Maybe you three work together and the you three work together. And with the men, also two groups of three, but have a different grouping than you had other times. I'd like you to make some sort of a graphic, and I'm going to give you flip chart paper to show how do we do this. How through bhakti do we develop this spiritual opulence of vairagya? Okay, thank you. What did you come up with? So, what did you come up with? Can we put them up on the wall? I don't know where a blue tech went. Oh, here it is. All right, let's look here at this one. So I see we have...
Just put it on
Okay, desire for material things, hearing from the proper source, getting a test, pain and suffering, become ready, get more guidance, follow sincerely. So this is just completely based on Chitraketu. Okay. Result, then
continue the process.
Continuing the process, another test of criticism, another consequence, Parvati's curse, another acceptance, and then becoming exalted. All right. So going devotion, little acceptance, then he never gave up. Very nice. All right. And then what's this one? So this one is accepting and following the instructions of the spiritual master, chanting the mantra with faith and devotion, rendering service, renunciation and detachment. Okay. Well, this tells me what, but it doesn't tell me how. It doesn't tell me quite how it works. Okay. Here we have studying the Vedas, becoming servant of the Lord, associating with devotees, one
reaches
Vairagya, then the mercy of Guru, Guru Kripa, knowledge of the truth. Okay, and by giving up bodily conception. The other I can't see because the Murdunga is in the way. We have taking association of devotees who are already exalted, hearing about the Lord and his activities, following the devotee's instructions by chanting. In this way, one develops tolerance and acceptance. Okay, oh, very nice. Okay, now I want to go on. Actually, I don't want to go on. I'd rather do some other things, but we can't. Okay, we want to... All right, look at text 30. Please get a piece of paper or a document on your computer. Do some little decoration on that paper or the document that says 61730. Write the number 61730 on your paper. Write it a few times or on your computer if you're going to use a computer document. Do a little decoration, some little flowers, some little something. 61730. 6:17:30, 6:17:30, and then on your nicely decorated paper or your nicely decorated Word document, look at the purport and write two or three sentences to explain how Prabhupada says that we become happy. There's something really amazing going on in this purport. I hope you all found it. Srila Prabhupada writes, everyone in this material world is distressed by miserable conditions, but Srila Prabodhananda Sarasvati said the world is full of happiness. Here again, we talked about this yesterday and the day before. Different levels. When people first take up Krishna consciousness, we tell them, this world is miserable, material life is miserable. And here, we're saying, you know what? If you're in the right consciousness, this world is happy. And it's all based on the mind. It's all based on the mind. The mind says, this thing that is happening, and please listen carefully, I'm only going to talk about this for 1 minute, because that's all I have. But this is an incredible secret. If this is all you get out of this week, this is a real key. The mind says, this bodily sensation, this circumstance is good. This bodily sensation, this circumstance is bad. And it's the mind that interprets pleasure and pain, not the senses. I mentioned this the other day. The eyes do not see, the mind sees. The mind says, this is pleasure, this is pain. There's no such thing as pleasure and pain. We talked about the computer game, the video game. It's ones and zeros. But if you have a character in the game, a certain set of ones and zeros will be pleasurable for you and painful for somebody else. but it's all ones and zeros. There's no such thing as material pleasure and pain. It is an illusion. It's the opinion of the mind. All pain is the mind's opinion. Now, this fact is not only known to Hare Krishna devotees, it's known in medical science, it's known by philosophers. It's known by people who aren't religious at all. And it's certainly known by people in other religious organizations. It's a known biomedical fact. Pain and pleasure is the mind's opinion. It's the mind's opinion. It's not an objective fact. You can have a broken bone and feel no pain. And you can have nothing that shows up on an x-ray and be in terrible pain. You can have something wonderful happen in your life and not enjoy it. Okay? Pleasure and pain is an opinion of the mind. If the mind is absorbed in Krishna, it ceases to have an opinion about the things of the world. It just doesn't form an opinion about them in terms of pleasure. And therefore, one only sees Krishna everywhere and one is simply happy. All right. I wish I had time to discuss it. I don't. Going on to text 31, the role of detachment and knowledge in bhakti, just very, very briefly. Detachment is not necessary to produce bhakti. Knowledge is not necessary to produce bhakti, but bhakti naturally produces detachment and knowledge. And the reason that people who are fully detached and have full spiritual knowledge without bhakti are still impure is because they're not satisfied. It's not enough. Again, it's boring. If we didn't feel any material pleasure or pain, it would just be boring. I mean, it'd be kind of cool at first. You know, like, whoa, everything in this world is just the opinion of the mind. It's all just the modes of material nature. Whoa, that's really wonderful. And if you ever read, like I have, people who've had this impersonal realization, and they'll talk about how wonderful it is, and pretty much all of them choose to come back to a realm of duality. Pretty much all of them. Because they were bored. I mean, you first read their descriptions of their Brahman realization and you think, whoa, that sounds really cool. I'd like that. To not be affected by anything in the world and just be the observer and see everything as the modes of nature. Whoa, that would be nice. And they'll say, oh yeah, that's nice. And then very quickly, they'll say, this is boring. I choose to go back into duality. And isn't that what Prabhupada says happens to the impersonalists? That means they're not pure. They're not at the platform of satisfaction. This is happening today in 2019. This is not just something in Prabhupada's time that he saw here in India. It's not just something in the Bhagavatam. There are people who become impersonally realized. And they're bored. But when you have bhakti, you get those things naturally on the side. And they're not even terribly important because what you have is so much better. You're just like, oh yeah, I'm actually kind of detached from the material world. I actually kind of know the material world. Oh yeah, right, where's Krishna? It's not so interesting. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah? It's just like, oh yeah. Like it says, liberation is standing there with folded hands. So now Lord Shiva says something interesting in text 32. He says, all of us, we don't know the Lord because we have a separate mentality. So of course he's speaking out of humility. That we can't know the Lord because we have a separate mentality. And this is a very useful, what she was doing is a very useful technique, shall we say, as a teacher. If you want to teach others, it's better to say we than you most of the time. You know, it's not very enlightening if I said, you know, all of you here, you're all conditioned souls bound by the modes of material nature, and you really ought to stop doing that and surrender to Krishna. And what you're going to think is, well, who are you, Arjuna? You know, it's like, it ends up bringing out people's ego and people's not interest in listening. But when you say, you know, we conditioned souls, or if you're just talking about yourself, you know, it's easy for me because I am a fallen conditioned soul, so I don't have to work very hard to think of some examples. But it's very effective if you say, you know, I'm a fallen conditioned soul, I have this problem. And what happens is when we admit to having some sort of problem, people are much more likely to also say, oh yeah, I can deal with that. I also can admit that I have that problem. Does that make sense? As a preacher of Krishna consciousness, this way that Lord Shiva is acting is very important. And I mean, it should be genuine. We should actually feel that I'm a fallen soul. And that whatever, bless you, whatever I have is by grace. That it's not like I'm some kind of great personality. Okay, so then Lord Shiva is talking about how everyone is dear to Krishna. And that Krishna doesn't have favorites. That's funny, he says, Krishna doesn't have favorites. And then he says, but Chitraketu is very dear to him. And he said, I'm also dear to him. So here Lord Shiva is making a point in text 34 to 35. He's making a point to his wife that Parvati thought Lord Shiva as superior to Chitraketu. Remember, she made a big deal about this? That who are you? Who are you? You're not Shiva's authority. You're his subordinate. You have no right to criticize Lord Shiva because you're not his authority. You're a junior. And here Lord Shiva is saying to his wife, you know what? We're both equal because we're both dear to the Lord. So although certainly from one way of looking at things, Lord Shiva is far, far above Chitraketu. He's a different tattva. He's a direct son of Lord Brahma. I mean, how is there any? He's one of the great guna avatars. Still, Lord Shiva is saying, you know, as devotees, we're equal. And this is actually the mood of the devotees. Both things are done. We recognize that there's some hierarchy, we recognize that some devotees are superior, but at the same time, there's a mood of equality. Both are going on simultaneously. And I often see this in our dealings in ISKCON. It's one of the very nice things that I often see in ISKCON. I don't see it all the time, but I see it very often, where devotees have a sense of equality, even though there's also a sense of hierarchy. That our sense of hierarchy isn't absolute. That, you know, we're all devotees, we're all worshiping the Lord, and there's some sense of equality in that. And he's saying we're always friends. And there he said, therefore, this idea of cursing Lord Shiva because he violated etiquette, you know, it wasn't real. Just like we hang around with friends, and we may insult each other, yeah? It's one of the ways you know you're intimate with somebody, is that you can insult them. Correct? Yes? It's one of the signs of intimacy, is you can say to somebody, hey, you know, do it. Now, I think it's really funny in this purport that Prabhupada says, it is clear that Chitraketu wanted to criticize the behavior of his friend Lord Shiva because Lord Shiva was sitting with his wife on his lap. Then, too, Lord Shiva wanted to criticize Chitraketu for externally posing as a great devotee, but being interested in enjoying with the Vijayadhara movement. This is 34-35. These were all friendly jokes. There was nothing serious for which Chitraketu should have been cursed by Parvati. So Lord Shiva is saying to her, you misunderstood this situation. You didn't understand the situation correctly. And I've run into things like this in ISKCON among devotees. That there's people talking and somebody else doesn't understand the relationships. And so they'll think that some offense has happened when it hasn't. Have you ever been in some situation like that? That there's people who are friends, and in friendship, they're talking loosely. They're speaking very casually. They're not following the etiquette of reverence. They're following the etiquette of
friendship.
And somebody from the outside who sees this, they become upset. And I've seen this happen. You know, because both things can exist at the same time. You can have two people where one is higher than the other from one way of looking at it, and from another way of looking at it, they may be equals. So I've definitely seen this happen. I mean, I tell you, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's kind of a funny story. I sometimes travel with one of my grandchildren. And one time I was traveling with my grandson Vikram, who's now Rasika Shekhar. So my grandchildren call me Grandma. So we were someplace in the world, and Vikram said, "Hey, Grandma." And one devotee walked up to him and said, "That's not a respectful way to speak to Mother Urmila." And the poor boy, you know, he said, "Well, why not?" I think the other devotee was thinking, "Hey, Grandma." It's kind of like saying, "Hey, old lady," you know? And Vikram says, "Why not?" He said, "Well, she's Mother Urmila." He said, "But she's my grandma." The other devotee was like, "Oh." So it's like that. You know, Lord Shiva is saying to Parvati, He's my friend. We're buddies. He can joke with me about you sitting on my lap, and I can joke with him about all his vigid argument if I want to. You know, hey, who are you with all your women? I just got one of them on my lap. You got a whole bunch of them in your airplane. You know, I mean, and they can do that. Because they know that they're not sense enjoyers in the world. They're actually devotees. So it's not a serious thing. And then Parvati felt
shame.
She felt that she had done something. Huh?
Wrong.
She felt she had done something wrong. She felt she had done something wrong. Did she do something wrong? This is the question.
It was in the previous text, it was said that he had tried, so mother, she punished the child.
Okay, so she didn't do anything wrong because he did have pride, and it was her duty to correct this pride.
And the Lord wanted to accelerate
Chitraketu, and the Lord was using Parvati for that purpose. She was acting in her position as the agent of the Lord. Why did she do something wrong? Oh, also, it's her husband. And you could say, as a wife, she's not supposed to tolerate somebody criticizing her husband publicly. It was her duty to defend her husband publicly. Why did she do something wrong? Yes. How could we interpret her behavior as wrong? We just said why we could interpret her behavior as not wrong.
Because there was not offense.
Because it was not actually an offense. It was friendly joking. She misinterpreted what was going on. Which means she didn't take the time
to figure it out.
To figure out what was going on. Do we ever do that? Do we ever jump to a conclusion?
Yes.
Like this guy who says to Vikram, "How can you talk to Mother Urmila like that?" He could have asked him, right?
Why do you have
to? "Oh, how come you call her Grandma?" Instead of immediately deciding that he needed to be corrected. Has anyone ever done that to us?
Yeah.
Immediately corrected us without finding out the situation? Hey, don't do that. Wait, I'm sorry, my town president told me to do this. Or the GBC told me to do this. Sorry, Prabhu. And they don't ask first, they just jump in. I mean, Parvati could have thought, well, Lord Shiva didn't say anything because he's just humble and he's not going to defend himself, but it's my duty to defend. So she's feeling some shame because she also sees that she had some fault here. Is this interesting that even though she's doing the will of the Lord, and even though there was a fault in Chitraketu, still she feels she did something wrong. Anybody want to explain that? That was so beautifully said. Even though the Lord uses us as an instrument, doesn't mean our own motives are all right. You know, like Kamsa said, well, I'm just the instrument of your karma. That doesn't mean he's innocent. So just because I'm the instrument of you, acting as the instrument of the Lord, doesn't mean that I have nothing to look at in my own heart. So Parvati had something to look at, and you know, if Chitraketu has stuff to look at in his heart and Parvati has stuff to look at in her heart, we probably have stuff to look at in our heart. So she felt some shame because although she had acted in her position as the mother of the universe and although she had acted in her position to correct somebody who was proud and although she had acted as the Lord agent, she also hadn't really taken the time to do things properly. She had acted precipitously. A precipice is a cliff you fall off. She had acted without proper thought, without proper care, without proper consideration. Okay, just the ending of this chapter. Sukadeva Goswami says, okay, there, and we go, the very end here. 39, my dear King Parikit, you asked me, now I've answered your question. So the whole Bhagavad Gita's questions and answers, one sort of nice class by Adi Purusha, where he was saying, and I wish we had time to discuss this, but he was saying that the speakers of the Bhagavad Gita don't go beyond the questions they're asked. They see the inquisitiveness of the person and they respond to that inquisitiveness. But something he didn't say, but that I would like to add to that, is they do something interesting. We have a saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You've all heard that? Well, there's another part to that called, you can put salt in his oats.
It's his oats.
Oats, you know what oats are? You can put salt in his oats. What will happen if you put salt in the horse's oats?
It has to
be. The horse will become?
Thirsty.
So you can't force someone to drink, but you can make them thirsty. And you'll find that the speakers of the Bhagavatam make the listeners thirsty. They tell a story, or they just throw out something. They just say, oh, by the way, and the cowherd boys didn't say anything about the killing of Vagasura for a year. And then, they put something out there that incites the curiosity of the listeners so that the listener asks a question which then prompts the speaker to speak. So if you tell people things they're not interested in, they won't remember what you tell them. But you can make them thirsty for what you have to say. Alright, then of course we have the benedictions here. Very nice benedictions. If we hear this story from a pure devotee, and I think we're hearing it from Prabhupada, we'll also become free, and if we chant it early in the morning, we'll go back to Godhead. Sound good? I don't know if 11 o'clock was early enough in the morning, but we've been reciting this in the morning, and so I think we're all going back to Godhead. Okay, we have finished the story of Chitraketu, and we will be going after lunch to another very similar kind of story of people's motives and desires. But this is even a deeper one. I mean, we had something in Chitraketu with the women who poisoned the child and so forth. and we have the motives of Chitra, Ketu, and Parvati. But now we're going to go into the motives of Diti and Indra. And this is it's a really fascinating psychological account of how we can, what's our real motives with what we do and how we can purify our motives. So thank you very much. And we'll see you again after lunch.